Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter, and you can follow me at The Kung Fu Genius. I got great news for KFG fans. For a limited time, you can get $5 off any order of $20 or more by using the code KFG5OFF at citywt.com. You can use this code for books, training equipment, t-shirts, and apparel. That code is KFG5OFF, and you can use that $5 off for any order of $20 or more at citywt.com. And that also includes using it towards my new book, The 15 Chi Sao Fundamentals, which just arrived and is still available while supplies last. The response to the pre-order was amazing, and we only have a few left, so get yours now. And you can always support this channel and podcast in simple ways, like subscribe to the channel, like the video, turn on notifications, and rate it wherever you get this podcast. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius will continue to discuss the secretly recorded conversation between Bruce Lee and his student Daniel Lee. Lots of gems, lots of F-bombs, lots of B-water flip-flops. Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. Watch out.
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Practiced all day like a genius.
Yo, Nick, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm good, Sibu.
Good to see you, man. It's been a minute.
It's good to be back.
Yo, did you change your shirt from the last episode? I can't tell.
You know, I don't think so.
Something just feels a little bit different about you. I don't know.
Little.
Yeah, you know, in the comments, people said you haven't looked yourself lately. Mm. Yeah, I just want to make sure you're okay.
I'm great.
All right? Okay, good.
I got the first dose, so I'm trying to...
That's what it is, right? It's one of them side effects, right?
Yes, exactly.
Got it. So anyway, here we are. Mm. This is our fourth part of talking about the Bruce Lee conversation.
Yes.
The secretly recorded Bruce Lee conversation between Daniel Lee and Bruce Lee, which we,
Daniel Lee is his student, right?
Daniel Lee's his student, which we kind of theorized probably very late 71, early 72, in terms of the timeline. It's basically when Bruce Lee had finished doing Fist of Fury, but had not yet done Way of the Dragon. And this part of the conversation, because, you know, for our listeners there, and by the way, if our listeners are, you know, have not heard the other parts, I would suggest you listen to part 1, 2, and 3.
1, 2, and 3.
And then you can kind of get caught up, because obviously we're going through the phone conversation.
Like going through a time machine.
Exactly. Yeah. And the phone conversation altogether, I think, is 22 minutes. And our first one or two episodes, we got through like 3 minutes of it, because there was so much to unpack. There was the fight that Bruce Lee had witnessed, which we first thought was that iconic total POS Tai Chi white crane fight, but then we were corrected.
Come to find out, it's another shit show.
Corrected by Hector Lee that it was something on TVB that there, you know, was some kind of martial arts contest or whatever.
Hector Lee.
But either way, Heckler, we'll call him Heckler Lee, because that kind of describes him perfectly, right? By the way, since he was like, you know, trying to correct me and everything on that, and I was going back, he hasn't commented again. So clearly he hasn't gone back and watched, part 2 and part 3, where we were like kind of coming back and trying to like, you know, say, hey, man, why don't you come on our podcast or whatever.
He's building it up, right?
Yeah. So anyway, in the last one I had to do, before we even got to the conversation in part 3, there was like 45 minutes of me going, this is all the cool stuff I found out since we did the last recording, right?
Because, more cool stuff.
Well, one of the great things about doing this podcast, and I sound like a broken record week to week, I mean, part of the reason why I do this is because I want to find out if there are people out there who know more about this stuff, who can talk about this stuff, right? Exactly, yeah. Right? And it's great because, you get a lot of positive comments and you get some people out there who are real fans. Right. But every now and again, you get someone who's like, hey, Mr. Genius, I got something for you, right?
We're not the only ones that know it all.
Yeah, we're not the only. I don't know anything, man. What are you talking about, right? I pride myself on knowing very, very little, but being able to talk quite a bit,
got
right?
So much pride in it.
And and it's funny, like, because there's like one or two dudes out there who are like trying really hard to troll. Except that the wall that they always run into is that I don't actually care if people, like, I'm not trying to sway anyone's opinion, right? Because if someone watches this podcast and they already think Bruce Lee is terrible, that he's overblown, he's not great.
What are we going to do? There's nothing I'm going to say that's going to change that, right?
And then what they're going to do is they're going to kind of cherry pick their facts and be like, well, didn't you know when this happened, or like, all right. All right, Mr. YouTube, you've convinced me. Bruce Lee, he's nothing. I'm gonna go. Yeah, Mr. YouTube commenter, you've convinced me with your facts. Yeah. Things that happened that you weren't there either. You know what? I'm not a Bruce Lee fan anymore. I'm gonna go start stamp collecting.
That's how it
right?
happens, though.
By the way, speaking of random Bruce Lee facts and stamp collecting, all right, I got something you probably don't know. In the UK, all right, you know, because people talk about everyone here. They go, why isn't Bruce Lee on a U.S. stamp yet? Right. Which is kind of weird,
Whoa.
Right? Especially when you consider, like, Elvis is on a stamp. And Elvis, he was great.
Yeah.
But he also did some weird stuff.
He did some karate.
But he also died on the toilet, right? And even he got a stamp, okay? All right? So when are they going to give Bruce Lee a stamp, right? That's kind of like, that's what we want to know, right? But here's the thing. Bruce Lee is on a stamp. He's on a stamp in the UK, in England.
Ooh.
All right? Now, here's something you might not know, Nick. All right? UK... They're not allowed to have any living people on a stamp, with the exception of the Queen.
Yeah, but to be fair, the Queen probably has been dead for about 20 years.
And you heard that right from the source, peeps, all right? We have a real Brit in the house right now, okay? So the Queen, she's alive, and she can be on a stamp. But other than that, one of the levels of entry into a stamp in England is that you need to be dead, all right? Bruce Lee... is on an English stamp. And the photo that they used is him fighting Chuck Norris in the Colosseum on Way of the Dragon.
With the kitten.
Yeah, well, the kitten's not in it, all right?
Although
the kitten's probably dead,
to
be fair, right? But you see Bruce Lee there, and the guy that he's fighting is Chuck Norris.
Yeah.
And Chuck Norris is still alive. So
hey,
that means,
hey.
Here's a Chuck Norris fact you didn't know. Chuck Norris is the
only
living person besides the Queen to be on a stamp in England.
Yo, Chuck Norris.
Yes,
good job.
It's actually a Chuck Norris fact.
It's a Chuck Norris
fact.
Yeah, it's a Chuck Norris fact that's actually a fact, right?
Amazing.
Unlike, you know, behind his beard is just another fist, right? Right. Where Chuck Norris's tears can cure cancer. The problem is he's never cried, you know, like
that's the problem, right?
Okay. So anyway,
I love those facts. We should just do an episode of reading Chuck Norris facts.
You might be right. So
usually
anyway,
my ideas are shit. But this is good.
Well, even as Confucius say, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? So anyway,
yes.
We've discussed. So up until now, what are the topics that Bruce Lee discussed? Well, he talked about this fight between, you know, the Tai Chi guy and the other person, and you know, and that we figured out is some kind of maybe perhaps some TVB thing, whatever, right? And he talked a lot about the problems of traditional martial arts, and you hear his massive respect that he has for boxing and boxers, right? How they go in there, they have a game plan, they're well-trained, and even with their so-called, you know, they're just two tools, but they come in there with determination and they're able to use it. So you see that Bruce had an absolute understanding of the efficiency and practicality of boxing. What else has he talked about? Well, he mentions some bullshit artists, right? He mentions Wong Jack Man and Lao Dai Jun, and we talked about that at length. And then, of course, I also discussed the Wong Jack Man fight, which is kind of the perennial topic, right? And then you have most people, you know, the only witnesses to that fight are, you know, few and far between.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of eyewitness accounts from people that are there, and there are always some people that are like, yo, no, man, Wong Jack Man won that fight. And we talked about that.
Because they were there,
right? Well, part of it is because in 1980, they wrote an article in one of the martial art magazines where Wong Jack Man told his side of the story. And that was the one where he said he put Bruce Lee in a headlock a bunch of times and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, but the problem is people read that article.
He messed up Bruce's hair.
Yeah, totally. He messed up Bruce's hair, right?
That's not cool.
No, it was terrible, man. That's worthy of death right there, man. All right. You can give me a shiner.
Yeah.
You can punch me in the mouth. Don't mess up my hair.
Fuck
all right?
My hair.
Those you really want to be.
Oh,
I got a fight on your hands, right?
Gears.
But anyway, but most of that stuff came from an article that was written, I believe, in 1980. John Little talked about it in the interview we had with him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this is some 7-something years after Bruce Lee died, right? And you always have this, like years after the fact, their memory seems to get better and better about certain things that happen, right? It only happens with fights and stuff like
what's
that, right?
Messed up, you know, it was actually funny. I just had a vision of Bruce Lee in the 80s, how funny that would be.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing that we were robbed about. You know, Bruce Lee dying in 73. We never got to see 80s Bruce Lee.
80s Bruce Lee would have been epic.
Now, mind you, he would already been in his 40s, so he would be my age.
Okay.
Well, I was saying that like, oh, he'd be super old. No. Only to remember, I'm 43. All
right? Right.
But yeah, can you imagine him in like some, either he's wearing like the Chuck Taylors, or he's wearing some old Jordans. He's got his hair feathered.
Oh, I love it. Because, right? You know, he was always on cutting edge.
Yeah, fashion. Totally. You know, I would even imagine he might have done a Michael Jackson-esque leather jacket at some point. Because he had some really slick leather jackets in the 70s, man. So you can imagine he might have done either the Thriller
80s Bruce
with
Lee.
with the kind of V style, or he would have done the Beat It with the multiple zippers, right? Mm. Mm. We'll never find out. See, we were robbed of 1980s Bruce Lee, man. That's absolutely, that's the real tragedy right there, right?
The tragedy.
That is the real tragedy right there.
Yeah.
What would Bruce have thought of hip hop? So many things, right?
Would he have loved, you know, Run DMC, Sucker MCs, like him saying the lyrics and just,
yeah, and you know that some rap group would have loved Bruce Lee. They would have put him in the video as a throwback. It'd be some Hype Williams directing Bruce Lee in something.
Oh wait, now right? It's 90s. Wait, you jumped
still up. It's even more throwback by the 90s, yeah, right?
Oh man,
yeah,
you know, what we got was Ron Jeremy.
We got robbed. That's what we got.
We definitely
got Ron Jeremy.
Ron Jeremy
in a Hype Williams movie. Oh, that's right, Two Live Crew. Oh, pulled that one out the pocket.
So basically, you know, that's kind of where we're at right now. So and then also Bruce talked a little bit about Thai boxing, and I talked about that in the last episode, that his somewhat critical response to Thai boxing was also based on the fact that Thai boxing back then is not the Thai boxing that it is now. Yeah. Thai boxing, like many other things, have developed. Also, interesting thing, before we get into the rest of the conversation, which I'm pretty sure we'll be able to, or hopefully finish by this episode. We should not have to have a part five, right?
Serious yardage
today. A 22-minute phone conversation, of course, takes us four or five episodes, right? Because that's just, so what else are we going to do, right? Okay? And it's after we finish this one, we'll be like, damn, what are we going to talk about? Yeah. Well, we could keep doing that Bruce. No, we did that already. Oh, man. Is there another Bruce Lee conversation we could talk about, right?
It's got
to
be.
So interesting. I was listening to the Joe Rogan podcast recently, and he had a GSP. On. And if you guys haven't heard that one, I know like some of our audience are really into Kung Fu. They're really into Bruce Lee. Some of them are not into the MMA.
Yeah.
And they tend to not like it at all. And like, I get it, but there is obviously some crossover there. Like, I'm a huge MMA fan. I love martial arts sports.
Yeah.
And which is why when people criticize traditional Chinese Kung Fu, and I agree with most of those criticisms, but I'm a Kung Fu guy, but I'm not necessarily a Kung Fu guy like the other Kung Fu people are. Like, I also like, I'm a huge
You're
MMA
a cool
fan.
Cool Kung Fu guy.
No, other Kung Fu guys are cool, but a lot of Kung Fu guys are really very stuck in the, you know, there's a logical fallacy called no true Scotsman. All right. And it's like,
break that down.
Which is basically, well, the reason why you haven't seen some Kung Fu guy go in there and just wipe everyone out in UFC is because there haven't been any real Kung Fu guys who've challenged any MMA guys. Or there's this one real Kung Fu guy living on a mountain somewhere, and if that guy just strolled in, he'd knock out everyone.
No, yeah.
He'd knock out them all one by one. Every single fight, he would just knock them out. He would take all the fights and knock them out, right? Mm-hmm. You have a lot of that in Chinese Kung Fu, where there's a certain religiosity about the beliefs in the methods and stuff, which are based on a lot of old folk tales and things like that, right? And a lot of this stuff, because I love Chinese Kung Fu as an art form, as a physical art form, and I believe that Wing Chun, along with some other Chinese Kung Fu styles, Southern Mantis, a few, even certain elements of Charlie Futt, I think are very practical for modern day fighting. It's just that certain aspects about the way they teach it need to be upgraded, including Wing Chun. Mm-hmm. And self-defense is a totally different realm than fighting in the ring with someone else.
Totally different.
And right? I don't mean like, because the problem is like, I'm the one Kung Fu guy that doesn't use the same argument that all the other Kung Fu guys do, right? They go, well, you know, in MMA or in sport fighting or in ring fighting, you can't gouge the guy's eyes out. You can't kick him in the balls. You can't use your twisting dragon technique to rip his throat out and then show it to him before he dies,
right?
And then that's, they go, so if you take away all those techniques, then I can't, you know, then you're taking away my Kung Fu and I'm not able to do it, right? And there's a very, very small percentage of that which is mildly true if the person who's using them is also well-trained as a martial artist, right? You can't imagine that you're someone who just shows up to a martial arts school twice a week just for fun, like a casual person. No, we're not talking about your hardcore student. Shows up, you learn a couple, poke the dude in the eye, kick the guy in the groin. And like with that, like if GSP attacked you on the street, you'd be like, I got this. I'm just going to poke him in the eye, kick him in the balls. All right? Because you would need to be at a really high, you'd need to be at a really high level to be able to poke GSP in the eyes and kick him in the balls, right? I posit that you could probably take most traditional kung fu instructors who are like, just kick him in the groin, poke him in the eyes, and you can put them in a ring with GSP and tell GSP, don't strike them. Don't do anything. All that dude is going to do is try to kick you in the balls and poke you in the eyes. I don't even think they'd be able to do it. He's not going to stand there and let you do it. He's going to move around, right? He just gets one little, he just grabs your foot and he's going to take you to the, it's not going to happen, right? But people really believe that that's the difference, right? I don't think there's that at all. Because first of all, if you're in a real street fight, all right, whatever a real street fight is, or let's say self-defense, all right? Well, GSP can also poke you in the eyes and kick you in the groin too.
Exactly.
People always forget that. He can also do that if those rules are off the table, right?
Yes.
So that's not really the real difference between self-defense and sport fighting. The real difference is this. Whether there are two types of violence you can encounter, right? You have social violence and predatory violence. Social violence, hey, what are you looking at? Push and shove. It's between dudes and alcohol, right? What are you looking at? Push and shove, and the thing escalates, and it's like, boom. Most social violence is avoidable if you're not a meathead, all right? You de-escalate, you get out of there, and if you have to move, you go, and it's a very quick kind of short thing, right? That's where most kung fu people, if they know how to use their art, could have a chance, all right? And if they're taught to defend that. The problem is they're going into a realm where they're now in a sportive combat back and forth with someone who's a highly trained athlete doing something they're not trained to do against someone who's really good at that, and that's a problem, all right? So if you imagine that the real difference between self-defense and sport fighting, all right, besides the rules, I mean, there are a lot of differences between the two. But there's one main difference, and it's psychological, and that makes all the difference in the world. In self-defense, well, I should say this, in sport fighting, you have two willing participants.
Two.
And in self-defense, you have only one.
Only all right?
The guy who's attacking you, he's a willing participant.
He's so willing.
You are like, what the heck is going on? You are not willing. And psychologically, that's very different than, okay, I'm going to go back and forth and try to test myself skill for skill with this guy here.
Right.
And if you do that in a ring where you don't have the element of surprise, and now you're dealing with someone with good footwork, good boxing footwork, good timing, powerful punches, and you have not trained in that, it's no wonder. You know, every time some video comes out, there's some Wing Chun idiot, you know, like this guy fighting Xu Xiaodong, the Chinese MMA fighter, right?
The famous.
Every time you hear this, he beats up a Tai Chi guy, he beats up a Wing Chun guy, he beats up one of these guys, right?
Man.
For me, that's not the headline. The headline is semi-professional fighter beats up rank amateur. Okay? It doesn't matter that that guy was a Tai Chi guy. It doesn't matter that that guy was a Wing Chun guy. And I'm not saying that apologetically to apologize, like I'm a Wing Chun guy. I'm not saying that. It says you have someone who's a semi-professional fighter, fighting people who probably don't even have one single ring fight, right? But you would have the same problem.
<They're bums.
laughs> You would have the same problem if you had a semi-professional boxer fighting someone who's not professional at all in boxing. You would have the same outcome. The problem is that some of these martial art guys are the poster boys for the Dunning-Kruger effect, and they really believe that they can actually go in there and do something, right? And if you want to go in the ring and fight using Wing Chun, well, then you need to have an understanding of ring tactics. You probably should learn some boxing. You probably should learn some kickboxing, distance, measure, timing, keep the guy away. And then when you have your opportunity, you go in there. And when I say that, that pisses off a lot of kung fu people, because then they'll tell me stuff. Yo, in the 80s, they were full contact kung fu contests, whether in Hong Kong or New York or whatever, where dudes were going in there using straight up kung fu, whatever style it was, beating up other people of other styles using straight kung fu. And I go, you're totally right.
Yeah.
But the problem is that's also a little bit of confirmation bias, because sometimes you have people who are just extraordinary fighters, no matter what style they do. They're very powerful, very dominant. And let's face it, in the 1980s, when you're at a local tournament, you're a kung fu guy and you're fighting someone else who's in a traditional martial artist, someone else who's in a traditional style. You're not fighting someone who has the ability to box, kick, and wrestle seamlessly together.
Mm-hmm.
You have someone who strikes in a particular way, maybe karate or taekwondo, mm-hmm. or maybe charlie fat, or maybe a kung fu style, and you are a Wing Chun person, a charlie fat guy, a mantis guy, whatever, and you're very skilled. Of course, you can have these slobber knocker amazing fights,
yeah.
but I would posit the average person who only knows a little bit of martial arts nowadays is better at piecing it together than the people were back then. And the reason is, you know, back in the 80s, right? We grew up in the 80s. Oh. If some boy said, yo, man, I know martial arts, what did he do? He did some shit that looked like he came out of a movie, right? Put, you know, jumping around, spinning, oh, doing some ninja shit and some dive roll, right?
Like that dude you met.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Back in Seattle.
Yes. Those are the dudes, if they don't know anything, they copy whatever is in the zeitgeist of that time period.
Right.
And in the 80s, that was like kung fu and karate, right? Nowadays, the dude doesn't know anything. What does he do? He throws some jabs and fakes a takedown.
Yeah.
All right? Because now, the dudes That's who don't know anything, they are copying MMA as the template.
Yes.
So even the know-nothing dudes know something about, like, how fights go. That okay. it's not just decided on the feet or with kicks or with punches, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everything's evolved, right? So when I talk about these things, man, people get pissed.
Ooh,
but anyway, aren't we supposed to be talking about Bruce Lee?
Bruce Lee, we got to go into this recording.
People got mad at me last time. We said, we talked for 45 minutes before we mentioned. Some guy's like, yo, you're meandering.
I
meander all the time, man. Just ask my wife, all right? Okay.
Let's do it.
What was that line in Star Wars? Stay on target. Okay. All right, so we'll continue right where we left off. So let's see where this takes us.
Sweep the foot away or make a judo throw, and poor Katai just having trouble maintaining balance.
Okay, so this is still the tail end of what we were talking about last time,
mm-hmm,
where they were talking about how to fight Thai boxing and talking about using judo throws, keeping them off balance. And the comment that I made about that is, in the old days, it was very common when you saw another martial art. You know, nowadays, when people want to learn how to defeat a martial art, they want to learn something about it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, who are the best people in stuffing a takedown? Wrestlers and grapplers. Why are they the best ones? Because that's their game. Nowadays, we intuitively understand that a little bit better. So that's why even in the school here, I like to teach you guys how to do takedowns and things like that so that you do them better, so you have a better understanding of it, right? And back then, they didn't really think that way. It was more like,
How do we defeat it?
Like coming up with
moves.
Yeah. All right, well, if he just does this, I'll do this, right? Rather than going, let's learn the ins and outs of, in this example, Thai boxing.
Mm-hmm.
How do Thai boxers move? What do they focus on? How do they do it? And then figuring out how do we avoid that? Because now you come from a point of having knowledge about that rather than just trying to find some trick to defeat
your
right?
enemy.
So even in here, you can still feel, it was the 70s, right? And as great as Bruce Lee was, and to be fair, this is actually Dan Lee saying this. This isn't Bruce Lee. It was still about the, you know, What is the secret move we'll use to stop the Thai boxers, right? Okay, so let's continue.
The kick is too high. That's right. And too obvious,
right.
Well, that's the whole deal, you see. There's no subtleness, no economy.
No subtleness.
That's why,
and there's no actually broken rhythm either. You can see it coming.
That's Don L. Sullivan. That's why 80% of the knockout is by hand.
By hand, right.
That's why this guy, crazy Raymond Adler, making all those things.
No, put him in the ring.
So they're talking about a guy named Raymond Adler. I didn't have the chance to do any research before this episode,
mm-hmm.
so I'm sure people in the comments will be like, yo, man, you don't know who Raymond Adler is, man? I learned from Raymond Adler for 80 years. I'll tell you all about him, right?
Yeah.
It just sounds like from this, he sounds like he's some kind of martial arts guy who's kind of boasting about how he can beat other styles or whatever. Because then you hear Bruce Lee talk about, yeah, kind of being a bit dismissive about this guy, right? Yeah, and he's basically saying, yeah, you put him in the ring with a boxer, and then that'll be the end of that. And that just goes to show you. And then you hear a little bit of a lull in the conversation. Mm-hmm. I think we're about to change topics.
Okay, then. I'm typing right now.
Yeah, I know you're busy, and I just want to be sure I at least have a chance to say hello to you.
This was Bruce Lee's first attempt to get off the phone. You know that when you talk to people and you're like, all right, man, so, like, it was good talking to you. And then, like, yeah, and then what do they do? They cut in, they bring something else, right? And why is that? Why does Dan keep the conversation going on?
Because he's recording
Bruce Lee.
Yo, that's...
right? And you hear Bruce is like, all right, well, I'm kind of busy, right? Okay. And it's, I think, speculated that Bruce was actually in L.A. for this conversation. So we discussed this is not happening from L.A. to Hong Kong. This is happening in L.A. Because he, I think, even mentioned that Dan was over their place in the last part or whatever, right? But I think that Bruce was, like, selling his home because he still had the house in L.A. while he was living in Hong Kong. So that's, I think, what he was talking about. I don't know if he just meant packing to fly back to Hong Kong or if he meant, like, they're packing up the house or selling it or whatever, something in there, all right? Oh, and also I have to correct something. In the last episode we did on the Bruce Lee conversation, I mentioned that Bruce Lee visited Hong Kong in 1963. Mm-hmm. And then I said, and then he went back again in 1966. It was 1965. I apologize. All right. Okay. My bad. Okay. Let's go.
Thank you. Well, glad to hear your voice again. And I'm selling my house, you know. I heard Danny told me about
it. There he goes. I'm selling my house, you know, right?
Yeah.
There it goes. Yeah. And then he said, yeah, Danny told me about it. I mean, Dan Inosanto.
Anything you want me to help you clean or something like that, for instance, let me know. Well,
hey, man, what are students for, to help clean the house, right? You know, Bruce Lee got that Marcy machine in Hong Kong, right? And the story was two of his students came over from L.A. to Hong Kong. I don't know if it was him. I think it might have even been, I don't remember who it was.
Okay.
But I think Bob Bremer might have been one of them. They flew to Hong Kong to put the thing together for him, right? And remember when we got the Marcy machine, I had you guys here putting it together for me, right? So apparently I'm following the steps of Bruce Lee, right? You know, we're not always the most mechanically inclined, but we get our students to go, you know, can you put my Marcy machine together, right? Can you clean my house? Help me. Moving out.
Yeah.
This is the old Confucian tradition here, right? Let's continue. Yeah, so that was and you see, like, he's not bringing in all of his stuff, right? And that's also, I believe that he left a bunch of his training equipment with one of his students. I think it was Bob Bremer, although I'm not 100% sure. And recently, his daughter, I think, sold all that stuff at an auction. Like, it was a bunch of, like, his jump rope, his boxing gloves, things like that. Because think about it, he was going to Hong Kong. He didn't want to have to bring all that stuff. And also, when he went to Hong Kong, he earned some money. So, I mean, he could buy new clothes, new training equipment, whatever. He didn't need to bring that stuff. So he left some of his old ratty stuff over there. And then you hear it's like, oh, and if I come back. Because originally the idea was he was going to go to Hong Kong, make a couple movies. And if they were successful, he was going to use that as his back door to come back into Hollywood, right? Mm-hmm. Because that was the Clint Eastwood template. You know, Clint Eastwood.
Spaghetti Westerns.
Yeah, went over to Italy, made those spaghetti Westerns, was really big, and then came back and then was finally established in Hollywood. So when Bruce was not having any luck in Hollywood, he basically wanted to do the same thing, supposedly on James Coburn's advice, although there's some conflicting reports on whether he said that or not. Okay. And so that's why he's like, yeah, well, depending, you know, if I come back, I'll just buy another house, right?
Well, I think actually whatever you do over there would have a tremendous impact off your work over here.
Depending. I mean, the quality of it is going to be. I mean, I'm not talking about myself alone, you see. Yeah. I mean, directing, budget-wise, and cinematographer-wise.
Yeah, so that was the other thing, too, and a lot of people don't really realize that Bruce knew that the quality of his first two movies, namely Big Boss and Fist of Fury, especially more Big Boss than Fist of Fury, was substandard quality compared to Hollywood. Okay. And he didn't really, from what I understood, plan on those movies being shown in the West. In fact, I later heard that, or I'd read somewhere, maybe it was in Matt Pauly's book, that when he found out that Raymond Chow had secured rights to distribute that film in the U.S., Bruce was kind of upset because he wanted to get famous in Hong Kong and get a name and then have Hollywood go, hey, this guy's making big movies, let's put him in one, rather than those, especially those early films, be shown, which is why he wanted to start directing his own movies like Way of the Dragon so he could create a film of the type of quality that he would be proud to show in the U.S. But his first two films, for him, weren't that. Although Fist of Fury is definitely a step above Big Boss. Like, mm-hmm. Big Boss is shot in Thailand. It's very cheap, right? But Fist of Fury, it's, you know, it's in a studio. It's the production values are much higher.
Okay.
But you can even see Bruce is like, well, depends on the quality, the cinematographer. Like, he's trying to, because Dan Lee's like, well, you're going to have a great impact over there. It's like, you know, that can only help you over here. And he's like, well, it depends on the quality. Like, you could tell he's trying to, it's like, they might not be that great. Like, just give it a moment, right? Yeah. But it's interesting, like, he's aware of that, right? Think of how many actors we meet in New York on a weekly basis who do these turd-ass independent movies that they think deserve Oscars. And you watch these things and you're like, oh, man. Yeah. Like, yo, man, could I show you my reel?
Yeah.
And they show you reel and you're like, ugh. And they think, for real, I should be in a movie with De Niro next. I'm like,
oh, goodness.
Don't quit your waiter job. Do you hear what he said about Hong Kong versus the standard in Hollywood? It's like, no, they can be. Mm-hmm. And what he's talking about there a little bit is Shaw Brothers had remarkably bigger budgets than Golden Harvest. And Shaw Brothers had some films, even at that time, that had really good budgets and really good cinematography. In fact, they were even copying a lot of the Japanese cinematography techniques at that time. But Golden Harvest, not so much, because they were still kind of new and fledgling. But Ooh. Bruce was brutally aware of this stuff. You know, like, how many people star in B-movies and don't know they're in B-movies? You know what I mean? Like, he's very aware of what's going on. And he understands this is just kind of a stepping stone to the bigger things he wants to do later.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, given the manpower and the facilities, I mean, you know, it's the Hollywood of China, right? They make more films sometimes, I know, in a year than the Hollywood area.
I mean, that's about it, you know.
Now, you actually, in The Big Boss, you speak Cantonese, right?
Yep.
This is also funny because remember, like, a minute ago, he was trying to get off the phone with him, right? And I was like, so in The Big Boss, you were speaking Cantonese, right?
Reeled him in.
Yeah, and here
that's what I do to you a lot.
Yeah, you do that all the time, man. I'm about to go and you're like, yo, can you tell me that story about how you learned the seventh set of the wooden dummy that one time? All right, here we go.
Now, you actually, in The Big Boss, you speak Cantonese, right?
Yep.
Then what do?
Yeah, so this is interesting, right? Because back then, of course, you didn't, this is even before VHS. So distribution meant in the theaters.
Yeah.
That's why he's like, yo, the movie did really well here. They're waiting for a really good deal. Because it's not like, okay, it's had its theater run. Now it comes out on VHS or whatever, right? That wasn't the deal back then. The deal was to secure theater releases in other countries. So it's like, that's why they're waiting to get the best deal.
Yeah, like the scene in the Dolomite movie with Eddie Murphy. He's going
Exactly.
To theaters. Okay.
Yeah, the film industry was totally different then.
Wow.
And it's also, you know, interesting there because he talks about they shoot it in Cantonese, but it's dubbed into Mandarin. And the reason really why this was the case is because mainland China is a communist country. And especially at that time, they didn't have a film industry, all right, besides, you know, pumping out propaganda films for their own peeps, right? But there was no real Chinese film industry that had any kind of international pull. But there's a huge, obviously in mainland China, the main language is Mandarin, right? But there's a huge Mandarin-speaking population outside of China, whether that's Taiwan or even in Malaysia, although a lot of Malaysians also speak Cantonese, but they speak Mandarin there, Singapore, and also in the States and elsewhere. So you have a big Mandarin-speaking Chinese population, the overseas Chinese who are outside of China.
Got it.
And that's such a big market. That's the reason why in Hong Kong, they dubbed the films into Mandarin for the international release, right? Because that was actually the language that they were going out in, right? So, you know, even when you watch the original Mandarin version, it's not Bruce Lee's voice because he didn't speak Mandarin. And two, you would see that, you know, we always laugh when we watch dubbed kung fu movies because right. you know, the mouth is moving this way. It's like, oh, we'd like to try you Wu-Tang style, right? And the mouth isn't, you know, matching or whatever, but they didn't even match in the original one.
What was funny is when I was little, I thought that was them speaking. Like, I thought that was them speaking English.
Oh, you thought Chinese doesn't match? Oh, you thought that's how they spoke English?
So I'm a kid. I'm like,
Governor, knock it on the edge.
Yeah, it's very confusing. It's very confusing, right? But yeah, you have to imagine, even if you saw the original Chinese version of that in Mandarin, it also wouldn't have matched up. It's literally another type of Chinese. So I assume that they then did a local Cantonese dubbing of them for the Hong Kong audience, right?
Got it.
So, yeah, but it's funny for him talking about that, right?
I opened a film company, recently called Concord.
Yeah, that's Concord. Concord Film Production, right?
Ooh.
And that is his company. And that's when he was able to have his co-production with Raymond Chow.
Right.
So he did that kind of after Fist of Fury. And the reason why he did that after Fist of Fury is because his initial contract with Golden Harvest was only for those two films.
He had
some negotiating power with Raymond Chow because the first two films were a huge hit.
Yeah.
Raymond Chow wants to re-sign him. He's like, okay, sure, but I'm going to have my own production company and now we go 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
So Concord was going to go 50-50 with Raymond Chow. And Bruce was supposed to be in charge of the creative side and Raymond would be in charge of the distribution. That was like the original deal. I don't know what he means, if he means Raymond Chow is his partner or if he had another partner on his side of Concord. That would be a good question for someone like John Little or for our awesome YouTube audience.
Yes.
We are eagerly waiting for this film to be here. I think you will like it.
Tong San Dai Heng is the name of Big Boss in Chinese, which oddly enough, is not Big Boss at all. All right. So the English title, Big Boss, references the villain. But the Chinese title, Tong San Dai Heng, references the hero. Tong is like it's another character that can mean China.
Mm-hmm.
San is mountain. So it's like the China mountain. It basically means China. Dai is big. Heng,
right.
Older brother, like Si Heng.
Yeah.
Same. So it's big brother from China. Because remember the story in Big Boss, he comes to Thailand from China.
Yes.
And then there's all this corruption stuff going on and he comes in there and whoops everyone's ass, right?
Thing. He has with the medallion he keeps holding. He's like, I can't fight.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
But he so wants to fight. It's like, oh!
So the Chinese title references his character. The English title references the villain. Okay. And then there he talks about the title of his second film, Jing Mo Moon. Jing Mo Moon is the name of the school. So, again, the Chinese title of Fist of Fury is not Fist of Fury. It's the name of the school of martial arts that he trains at, which actually was a real school in Shanghai. So now we're on the last bit.
Oh, well, that's historical figures. You have no. I am from God's student. I see. You see, I'm not from God's.
So that's really interesting. So the second film that he did, Fist of Fury, which is Jing Mo Moon, which is loosely based on a true story.
Oh, right.
I mean, the story is not true. I shouldn't say loosely based on a true story. I should say based on people who existed.
Okay.
Okay. So the founder of the Jing Mo Moon or Jing Wu Men in Mandarin was a guy named Fo Yun Gap in Cantonese. In Mandarin, it would be like Huo Yuan Jia, but my Mandarin is terrible. My Cantonese is not much better either. But he was a real character, supposedly. Although there are some people that dispute whether he actually was the founder, because the story was he died under mysterious circumstances. And, the big folklore is that he was poisoned by the Japanese or something like that, right?
Ooh.
And because the two actual founders of the Qingwu Academy in Shanghai were two businessmen. And they came up with this idea to actually have a professional martial arts school. The Qingwu Academy is perhaps the first professional martial arts school in China. Yeah, because up until then, you know, you were just taught by your sifu in, in the backyard, or it was very small. You didn't have like professional schools.
They were thinking and, way outside the box. Nice.
Yeah, but it was beyond just martial arts. It was actually, they created what's kind of known as a physical culture gymnasium. And even like our association, we call the Wing Chun Athletic Association, in Chinese, Tai Yui, which means athletic, like an association for athleticism, right? For movement, right? Yeah. Tai Yu Wei, the original Jing was the Jing Mo Tai Yu Wei. So when Yip Man created the Wing Chun Athletic Association, Wing Chun Tai Yu Wei, he's actually using that same idea there, right? So it's actually similar. So it goes beyond just being a martial arts association. It's a physical culture, a place where you do physical exercise and
like
martial arts.
YMCA type.
A little bit, yeah. And martial arts is one of the things on offer, right? And that's why when I created my own association, I didn't want it to be the City Wing Chun, you know, like use the term fist art association like you might in Chinese, or, you know, fist study association or something like that, because that limits it just to that. I wanted it to be a little bit more, you know, like we have a gym, physical culture, all those things. That's why I used athletic association over just using like fists or, you know, fist art association, like many of the other ones do.
Okay.
So I use that as well. But so that, so Huo Yuan Jia, or Fok Yun Gap in Cantonese, was the founder of that. And then he died under mysterious circumstances, right? So, but there were two businessmen who really founded the Jingwu. So it's been theorized by some, I've had some conversations with some salty old dogs in Hong Kong, and they're like, Fok Yun Gap was not even a real Kung Fu guy. They actually said he was just, their words, they called him, he was just a coolie who worked there.
Oh.
But they needed to have a figurehead, because they're starting a martial arts association. You have these different martial art masters. Maybe you, and they also had things like Western bodybuilding and archery and all this other kind of stuff. But they needed to have a figurehead for the martial arts portion of it.
Okay.
So the story, one of the stories was they just grabbed this one dude out
of
the back.
He was an attractive guy.
Took a photo of him, and they were like, you know, he's the master of that school, right? And he was the teacher of this very rare Mi Zhong Kun style, whatever. And he had the northern hat and all that stuff, and he was known as the yellow-faced tiger. But the reason why he was a yellow-faced tiger was because he had jaundice.
Oh,
okay. So again, there's a lot of like, well, so what is this dude? Was he legit? What is it? You don't know. But then there's a lot of people that say, yeah, he was a legit martial artist. The only reason I'm saying this, and again, because people always get so upset, you say Fok Yun Gap is not real, because there are people out there who are in that line. I'm not saying that. I'm telling you what I heard. Okay? Because I have a zero skin in the game as to whether Fok Yun Gap was a real dude, a fairy tale dude, or some dude they grabbed out of the kitchen, took his photo, and then that was
it.
It's not, I'm going to sleep tonight, all right? And if you practice martial arts in his lineage, you probably know more than I do.
Yeah.
People don't need to get upset about this stuff. It makes zero sense, right? But what Bruce says here, what Bruce says here is really interesting. He says, well, in the movie Fists of Fury, he's playing Fok Yun Gap's student. And then he tells Dan Lee, because there's a lot more creative leeway by playing the student rather than playing him, because Fok Yun Gap is a historical character and you have to play that person according to the facts, right? You know, just like they do in all the Yip Man movies, because all the Yip Man movies are super factual, right?
Of course.
Hong Kong has never taken a real life character like Wong Fei Hung or Feng Sai Yuk or Yip Man and fictionalized their story. They've never done that, right? Yeah. So anyway, he's saying that it's easier to play the student because maybe the people don't know.
Yes.
Now, I've actually read that because Bruce Lee's character, his name is Chan Zhan. Chan Zhan is, Chan is Chan, right?
Okay.
But supposedly that was the name of a real student that trained at the Jingwu Academy. So apparently the producers or the writers or whoever wrote the movie, They went to they got a student roster from the Jingwu Academy to find the names of the students, and they just looked at the list and they saw this name Chan Zhan, And it's a very nice name. Because Chan, of course, is a surname Chan, and Chan means like true. So it's a very nice sounding name. And they said, Chuk, and they pointed to him, and that is the guy who that's Bruce Lee's character. But the joke was, he was, that name, Chan Chan, was just some dude off a list. He could have been the lousiest student at the Jingwu Academy. Only like
the NIFCA of only, the yeah, school.
Only to be immortalized by one of the most famous martial artists ever.
Yes.
You know, but it's like if you could go back and actually see Chan Chan training, he might have been the dude who was stumbling, falling, punching right. himself in the face, right?
Oh,
only like that dude is going to be played by Bruce Lee and that dude's going to be the hero. So then, of Great course, stuff. They play up the whole story about Fok Yun Gap being, you know, betrayed by the Japanese and killed or whatever. And then Chan Chan mm-hmm. returns and, of course, gets revenge on the Japanese,
oh,
right? So let's continue.
So I'm actually portraying his student.
Oh, portraying his student?
Yeah, and Harley Hinsberg, because I fought with the Japanese and the Russians and all that. That's right,
Fought with the Japanese, which were, some of them were played by actual Japanese actors, and most of them were played by Chinese actors, and the Russian guy was played by an American.
The fight seemed that, you know, really tremendous. I like them myself. I enjoy them. So, you know.
Yeah, and there's a huge jump in the choreography between Big Boss and Fist of Fury.
Mm-hmm.
One, Big Boss, he doesn't even fight for most of the movie because he's got that promise, right? And then when he does, it just makes it's a little bit like Jaws. You don't see the shark.
No.
You know, which also makes
you
it
just
better.
Hear the
like,
music.
There's this like build up, and then finally when he kicks, it looks so much better than it is just because you waited so long for that payoff, right? But in Fist of Fury, he's able to do more. And you see he does some Wing Chun stuff. He just kicks. It's the first time he brings out the nunchucks. He's fighting multiple people, singled
into
it. It's a lot more going on. And he was also somewhat encumbered by, in Big Boss, that was his first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the fight choreographer was Hong Ying Git. And Hong Ying Git was the bad guy of Big Boss. You know, the Big Boss at the end? That's
in the mansion.
Yeah, well, that guy was the choreographer.
Wow.
Okay, and Bruce got along well with him.
Something like that, choreograph a movie and be the
and then be the bad
be
guy.
Be the bad
right?
guy. Why
but
not?
It's also partially because Golden Harvest was a new studio, and it's like you're going to be the choreographer and the villain. Like, you know, it's like you're gonna wear eight hats in this movie. It wasn't that he was so awesome. It
right.
was like, I'm going to pay you this flat fee, you're going to choreograph the movie, and you're going to be the bad guy because we don't want to hire someone else.
We don't have a villain yet. So,
exactly.
Yeah, you're good at it. So,
Hong Ying Kit had a lot of pull in terms of the choreography and stuff like that, but he gave Bruce Lee a fair amount of leeway in their fight.
Hmm.
He was the standard studio choreographer for Golden Harvest, at least in terms of working with Lo Wei.
Mm-hmm.
But for the second movie, Fist of Fury, people saw what Bruce Lee could do, and Hong Ying Kit was listed as the choreographer for Fist of Fury, but it was Bruce Lee's show.
Wow.
Because at that point, Bruce respected, from what I can tell, he respected, you know, Mr. Hong, all right?
Yeah.
But by the second movie, he didn't really have to pay attention to him because they're going to let Bruce Lee kind of do his own thing. However, to save face for the old man, they allowed him to choreograph one fight scene in Fist of Fury himself. And it's the only fight scene that Bruce Lee is not in. So if you recall in Fist of Fury, there's one scene where after Bruce beats all the Japanese guys up, right? And then he goes out. The Japanese come to the Jingwu school to kind of look for him, right? And then they come and they have a fight in the courtyard and they beat up a lot of the Jingwu students.
Okay.
That scene was choreographed by Mr. Hong. All right.
Got it.
And that's why you see when you see them practicing in the courtyard, you see them going back and forth. The choreography is very stilted. It looks like an old kung fu movie. It's almost out of place for the choreography of the rest of the movie because that's the one part Bruce Lee didn't choreograph, right?
Makes sense.
All right, let's continue.
The regular people, you know, can't really different. Today I find their own style. Russian players like the Russian wrestler and all the Russian fight, you know, like karate and all this boxing. Wrestling, everything, all together. And I bite him and everything.
And I bite him in the grappling exchange, right?
All help at the end, you know, tall guy, you know, at the rented area.
You see that he talks about that scene, the sign with the no dogs and Chinese allowed?
Yeah.
That's huge. That was huge. It was culturally very big deal because it was one of the first times that a Chinese actor kind of stood and said, you know, it's okay.
Yeah.
You got to stand up tall.
That's what, and we all that. Felt that.
And everyone yeah. felt that, man. Yeah, but you see this, the film is very nationalistic, it's very like, you know, but you see that Bruce Lee was very proud to be Chinese, right. And he stands there, and there, he drops an F-bomb, right?
Yeah.
Are we going to edit his F-bomb? I don't know. I don't think
so. We don't have to.
No, we don't have to. We'll leave it in there.
Sure.
I'll edit your F-bombs. I will never edit a Bruce Lee F-bomb.
I don't think I've dropped any yet.
Because a Bruce Lee F-bomb is a very rare thing indeed, right? But it's so funny how he stands there and he just says, like, you know, F you, and then he runs, and then it freezes, and then bop, 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 right? And it's a very meaningful death. And that is the end of the movie, right? And it's like, wow.
And now I'm picturing Bruce Lee hanging out with Michael Jordan, Air Jordan, you know? Like,
pretty awesome. Let's continue. And the audience will eat it up. He knows he's playing to his audience there, right? Yeah, he's saying that the Chinese audience kind of a rough audience because if, you know, if they don't like it, they're going to say, right? But if they like it, they'll clap their hands, right? Obviously, he's talking about Way of the Dragon, you know, it's about the Chinese. He goes over to Europe and he doesn't speak any English. And this is why when I have friends, they're Bruce Lee fans. They've never seen Way of the Dragon if it wasn't dubbed in English. And I go, that movie makes no sense dubbed in English, because when you watch it in the original, I don't understand Chinese. I mean, it's OK. It's subtitles. All right. Because the whole thing is that he goes there and he doesn't speak the language everyone else speaks, right? But when you watch it dubbed in English, where everyone is dubbed, he's always going up to people like, hey, tell him. And it's like, dude, I remember watching it as a kid. I'm like, dude, you're right there. Why you keep telling him to tell him? It makes no sense, right? You have to watch Way of the Dragon in Cantonese, all right? Because in the original Cantonese version, the people who speak English speak English. People who speak Cantonese, right? You can't watch that in English. The movie makes no sense. So he talks about his fourth film already. He's like saying, oh, the next one, he's going in there. But he doesn't really say what it is. So it's not 100% clear. He's like, Silent Flute is the movie that he wanted to do for the longest time. And it just couldn't get done. Right. Mm. But then he goes, yeah, but it's going to be like Silent Flute, but like, you know, a little bit different. OK, so is he talking about Game of Death? Because that is the thing that he started working on after. But it could also be Lam Kun Bak Toi, which is the Southern Fist, Northern Kicks. I don't know if he was already writing that, but both Game of Death and also the Southern Fist, Northern Kicks idea that he had were based on the idea of Jeet Kune Do philosophy. So at this point, we don't know which one he's. I mean, we would assume it's probably something about Game of Death, sure, but it could also be the other one.
About this.
Very meaningful and entertaining as well. You know, I heard this, there's a film that a picture taken over here, something about Chinese Kung Fu and all that, well, yeah, Hong Kong.
Yeah.
It's a television deal.
It's called Kung Fu, and I was supposed to do it.
Yeah.
But the network decided against it.
Mm.
And Warner wants me to be in another television series, you know. And I'm glad they decided against it. Because if not, I would have been tied up this year.
But see, that's also the proof that Bruce Lee wasn't the one who created Kung Fu, which was always the theory that he created the idea for Kung Fu and then they gave it to David Carradine. That was already their project. They mm-hmm. considered Bruce Lee for it and then didn't go with him. But Bruce Lee's project, the one he was thinking, is the one that has now become The Warrior.
Right.
Right? The one that, and they just renewed that for the third season, too. So because people think, like, oh, Bruce Lee came up with this idea and then they stole it and gave it to David Carradine. The Kung Fu TV series was something that was in production and they had considered Bruce Lee, but mm-hmm. then said no. Right? But honestly, when you look at how things turned out, it was better that Bruce Lee did movies. I mean,
yeah.
Do you really want to see Bruce Lee in a TV series?
That's right.
Especially
that's
at that time.
Yep. Well, when you come back and do another good series, I don't think...
television is really... I mean,
it's one-shot jobs.
You look at all the television series. I mean, all of them are gimmick.
That's
right. Shallowly treated.
That's very much so.
I mean, you look at it. Manix, Ironside. I mean, it's all...
And Bruce Lee says himself, I mean, look at the TV. It's very formulaic or whatever, especially the TV back then.
Yeah.
TV now is amazing. TV back then was extremely formulaic.
He's done some TV.
He had done it already, and he knew he was beyond that. That was just a paycheck for him.
Yeah, right.
You have to put, that's right, man. You got to put a few months in it, you know, and work on it.
Yeah.
But not television, man. You got to finish in 1 week.
That's right.
And,
yeah, it's all got to be done under a tight time constraint.
How can you keep up the quality every week?
Very much so.
Yeah. And people get tired of it.
Yeah, and even so, sometimes you got...
And it was not my bag, you know what I mean, Dan?
It's not my bag. 1970s, man. I love this slang. Didn't Austin Powers say, yo, that's not my bag? Yeah. Some with the Swedish penis pumps. Yo, it's totally my bag, baby, right? Yeah. That book came out, right?
That's exactly what it's not my bag, baby.
Love it.
All right, we got 30 British seconds slang. Left.
You want to really actually get deep. That's right. You know, money comes back.
That's right. I think sometimes that could be a very much of a...
That's why.
Yeah, money comes second, right? Yeah.
That's why they ban all the schools, you know, because it is very...
And that's where it gets cut off.
It gets cut off.
And there you go.
So we don't know how much longer the conversation
Yeah, you can
goes
imagine
on.
Maybe Bruce Lee tried to peace out three more times. All right, man, I'm getting a little tired. Dad's like, hey, tell me about that script again. Can we talk about the straight lead in Jeet Kune Do?
Oh, God.
I know this, but my students do this all the time. Now that I'm listening to this, I'm going, you know what?
We do that to you all the time.
You guys do this to me all the time.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And you always fall for it.
Yeah. All the time.
We love
and
it.
There you go. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that. Let me know, out of all the four parts of this Bruce Lee conversation, which was your favorite part? What did you like best? And what would you guys like me to talk about in the future? And I'll see you guys next time.
Word is I'm a kung fu genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpass us. Your kung fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the...
Water flip-flops. All right, and so you know the thing, it's like, when you get it right, you got to go, let's get to it. And then he goes, did it, and then you do like a little thing, right?
Okay.
Okay.
Let's get to it.
All right, we ready?
I got to memorize this, man. I got to memorize this.
I'm going to f*** this up.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of the... I shouldn't look down.
You can't be looking at... You're supposed to look right at the camera.
A lot of F-bombs. All right, peeps. On today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the genius continues to discuss the secret conversation with Bruce Lee and his student Daniel Lee. Lots of gems. Lots of F-bombs. Lots of water be water flip-flopping. All right, let's get to it. It says water be flip-flopping. It says water be flip-flopping.
It says be water flip flops.
Flip flop? I thought that was flip flopping. You see, that was flim flam, man.
So close.
Jimmy Two Takes. Jimmy Two Takes.
Jimmy Two Takes.
Jimmy Two Takes.
Yeah, he's not a one take Jake, he's a Jimmy Two Takes.
Jimmy Two Takes.
Dre's a 13 take Jake. Look right in that camera and
bring love to it. All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius continue to discuss. I covered my face when I was saying that shit. Start again.
Shit's not easy, right? Only it's looks easy, yeah.
That's why you gotta love Dre, man. I'm like, I see those outtakes, I'm like, oh, this motherfucker. All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius continue to discuss secret conversation. You know, we can move this shit over.
No.
You can't move that shit
No.
Over. All right, let's just do it. Multitude of f**ks going on. Okay. All right. All right, peeps. On today's... Oh, I'm looking over here instead of over there.
He's going to call you Lazy Eye Dre. Remember Left Eye Locus?
Left Eye Locus.
Lazy Eye Dre.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, I do look lazy eyed. I'm looking at you. I just caught that. All right, you said look at the light, right? The light is what I'm
No, you gotta look at the lens.
He's looking at it right now.
On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius, what's the genius talking about? Yes.
Not bad.